How are yous? This is the first time I've ever been asked to perform on Culture Night. And lo and behold, way down in Cork, thank you so much for having me, folks. So, one second. I always have to wait for my grandparents to come in. They're here. Say hello to my Nan Thomas, please, folks. Great. They died in 1986 and 1999, but they come to all my gigs. I feel so much better for it, so thank you, Granny, thank you, Granda. I'm going to kick off. My name's Abby Oliveira, and I do spoken word, mainly performance poetry, and this past couple of years I've been doing a little bit of experimenting. I've been working with some musicians and everything, so I'm going to do a little bit of all that for you tonight, and I hope you enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, come and talk to me at the end. It would be nice to talk to some of yous. And I don't have anything to sell yous at the moment, but what I do have is a card, so you can come and join my Facebook page. Very exciting. Thank you. I'll start off with this one called I Talks to I. Who is the shepherd of your own mind? How fast did you learn to scribble inside the lines? Whose fearful mouth told you your scribbling wasn't art, and who even defines art when it soothes a screaming mind or heals a heart? Who made tracks with your creativity, tied you down with chains that only exist in your brain, and why are you still laying there waiting on the train? Who gains from this self-sacrifice? Princess, priestess, empress, goddess, who do you keep trying to impress? What you're trying to express? Cause like milk from the breast, expression nourishes only with what you've given it to nourish with. Tell me, what's your first thought in the morning? Cause what you think most of on any given day is your God, and everybody's got one. Who is the cunt, the bastard, the prick in the darkness of the part of you where no political correctness exists? Who is the shepherd? Think of him. Never ever forget him, and then picture picking up his cranes and scribbling all over the wallpaper, obliterating the lines in a Jackson Pollock style and opening the doors to perception. Imagine, just for argument's sake, that everything he's saying is right. Then what are you gonna do? Die? No. You pick up that pen and you write. You dive into that looking glass and be thankful for every shard of yourself you find. You quit crying all the time about getting cut and start stitching, creating mosaics. Stop fearing your own reflection. You turn to him, shake his hand, thank him for the checklist, start ticking off the lessons and adding all your best bits. You make today the day to start scribbling out all the bits of his diagnosis you know are wrong, and you love what you're drawing. Don't let the first rays of a new world phase fade when the day dawns with nothing on but ripped tights and wrecked mascara. Girls, you know you're so much greater. Like you know time is getting faster, and the last grains in the glass are far too precious to waste them craving permission, validating ignorance, voluntarily dumbing yourself down for pack acceptance. Woman, be the breath that uttered the word that said, there will be no more self-harm. No more Jackson Pollock patterns scribbled up my arms. No emotional scars as jewelry. No angry stones in my kidneys, and no gems in my pockets that could ever hope to outshine me. And no shepherds. You are no sheep. You did not stray from the flock. You bolted. You cast away your compass. Thank you very much. Cheers, folks. Now here's where it all gets a bit awkward, where I try and piss about with this MP3 player and stick on some music. So, if I get stuck with this and it doesn't work properly, you can talk amongst yourselves until I get it to work, okay? This next one is called Priestess. And I did this along with some musicians from Derry. They did me up this wonderful bit of music for it. So yeah, priestess. And it's for all of you who need to find your inner priestess, and that goes for you too, boys. So yeah, priestess. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Can you hear that music?
Yeah.
Can you hear it now?
Yeah.
Can you?
Yeah.
I can't hear it. Alright. Shh. So I don't miss my cue, right? Okay, priestess. The fact of death is what makes us live. Whether we strive with all our hearts to give or just hoard it all for survival. Seek out rivals to immortalize ourselves. Invoke revivals of the undead past, because it just looks far healthier than our present. Nothing will ever be as gorgeous as it was back then. Nothing will ever be as revolutionary as the moment you find yourself here, awake and aware, the mistress of your own affairs, the priestess of your own house, and he who dares could never conspire to bring the structure down. The fact of our death should make us crave to live, but it doesn't. You just feel like a clown for mentioning it. Remember, you're in public and the moment disappears in a blink before you can think. The tap of freedom on your tongue disintegrates to bits and the fear takes the buzz away. It takes 1 second to build a wall when fear is your masonry, enslaves your mentality, and the numbers all you've been since your birthday. All it takes is one taste for us to long forever for the hit, not even knowing why we're craving it. We all long for some place where death is the illusion, man, and until we get there, what? We're all just gonna keep on fighting, abusing, warmongering, using, frowning in the mirror, crying into our booze, cause something here is higher than us. Everyone can feel it. Not a ladder high enough for any of us to reach it. Listen to the penguin man in mass, even as he preaches it. I know I needn't be here, cause I can hear the way he bleaches it. Visited the dealer once who said he could see Jesus. Sold me something dangerous that left me dull and sleepless. I was kneeling on my knees, my arms to Venus, wishing on a fallen star to make me a priestess. Wishing on a fallen star to make me a priestess. Can you see her now, alright? Can you see her now?
Okay.
You see, in these dark days, we stumble like junkies in the cities, holding out our hands, begging for somebody to show us the way. And even the searchlights look like headlights, and we're caught in the paralysis between fight and flight. These dark days, everyone claims to know the answer. Everyone's an angel, an actor, or a gangster. Everyone's too poor, or too pampered, or too pandered to understand. The only holiness is inside you, so we fight, abuse, warmonger, use, frown into the mirror, cry into our booze. We're fighting and abusing, warmongering and using, frowning in the mirror, crying into our booze, cause something here is higher than us. Everyone can feel it. Not a ladder high enough for any of us to reach it. Listen to the penguin man in mass, even as he preaches it. I know I needn't be here, cause I can hear the way he bleaches it. Visited a dealer once who said he could see Jesus. Sold me something dangerous that left me dull and sleepless. I was kneeling on my knees, my arms to Venus, wishing on a fallen star to make me a priestess. This is the instrumental bit, so you can talk amongst yourself for 10 seconds.
It's vodka.
That was vodka. Stuck in the party bubble, on a high sea of stale alcohol, feeling like a sodden fag bob bobbing in a teacup. What happened to getting up love and buzzing off the future? What happened to being so sure life itself was something to live for? When did your thoughts start becoming so preoccupied with war? Looking you grinding your teeth in your sleep in those dreams where you must answer to the mirror. How much smaller will you shrink before accepting? For some fuckers you'll never be tiny enough to be stuffed into their narrow perceptions. Your heart's a willing tour guide, your imagination's a weapon, and etiquette's greatest ever trick convinced us not to use them. Etiquette's greatest ever trick convinced us not to use them against anyone or anything but ourselves. And they say hell is other people. Hell is other people, some philosophical Frenchman said. And hell is also a construct to keep us docile and complicit, while evil spreads like syphilis and girls want to be princesses instead of most high priestesses. Thank you very much, folks.
From the volume of 93 up.
That's it up as high as it's going to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about as high as it's going to go.
You monitor it,
yeah.
That's the point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can hear it. It sounds all right out in the room.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. That's good.
Speaker in the back.
As long as it sounds all right in the room, that's good. Yeah. Thanks, folks. Okay. This next one's called Dandelion, and it's dedicated to a friend of mine. It's really about the transformative power of art, which I'm sure we probably all know a little bit of something about. And, yeah, this is dedicated to a friend of mine who transformed her life by discovering art. And it's called Dandelion. You are a dandelion, my friend. You bring light in. It's your nature. You grew out in the backwoods, nurtured by burnt earth and beer tins, karaoke machines and discarded roaches. And though most of the estate didn't know it back then, you are medicine. Put here to help heal the sickness, where all talk of living is silence, to allow folk to die in peace, believing themselves to be only weeds. This is where you learn to be an artist, where you ripped up that concrete like Andy Dufresne, spent every day chipping away at those condemned walls with paintbrushes and needles, threaded like your life depended on it, because it did. Our kind, we don't just scribble for amusement. Our kind, we learned to do this by writing our own lifeline since we were kids. Saw characters inhabiting other worlds in patches of ripped wood chip next to our beds. We learned to storytell while our mothers broke ornaments and promises not to hurt themselves. Girl, there will always be those who only want to focus on our grammar, our proud use of the vernacular, our bad syntax. They will not know about the tiny porch you turned into a workshop and dreamed, of playing Buddha cat in college, learning to stilt walk and dreamed, the part-time hours away singing as you cleaned, dreamed, planted hanging baskets, painted glass, even as that bastard punched harder for every flower in your cap, knowing rightly that not even this jungle could hold you back. Like seeds don't know what kind of flowers they'll grow up to be, so you might never see the butterfly effects of all your courage. Have faith, my friend. They may sprout in the most bitter, the most contentious of places, and then, like you, they will thrive in the worst soil, like the best wine. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, so this next one I'm going to do is called Apocalypse Lil and The Night to Remember. The Night to Remember, who knows that film, Night to Remember? Yeah, go on, name that shit. Now, there you are, free drink for ye. So,
talk to Paul.
So yeah, a couple of years ago it was the centenary of the Titanic. And so a visual artist, she what do they call it when they pay you to write something? Come on.
Commissioned.
She commissioned me to write this because basically she felt that what was missing from the whole celebratory narrative was, for a start, the blatant division of class on the Titanic, and the fact that they were, well, she reckoned there were no black people around in the allowed on the Titanic at that time, but a couple of people tell me this is not true now. However, so she wanted that, and this is called a toast, and toasting came out of the jail cells in the cotton fields of the deep south of America. So basically you had a lot of men standing around, and they used to, this was a verbal art, they would tell each other these toasts. So there's a very famous one called Shine in the Titanic, and Shine, he's a black guy and he works on the Titanic, and basically nobody wants to listen to him because he keeps trying to tell them the ship is sinking, and no one wants to listen to him just because he's a black guy, so he just goes, right, bugger he is, and he jumps off the ship and he saves himself, and then it's too late for all the rest of them. So the whole thing about toasting is that it's a celebration of the underdog. So regardless of historical accuracy and all that, it's about oppressed people celebrating and having a bit of crack. So this one, which was supposed to be female-centric, so which is why I've chosen Apocalypse Lil. Her name is Apocalypse because she's a fortune teller, right? So this is called Shine, no, it's not called Shine the Titanic, it's called Apocalypse Lil and the Night to Remember. One smoggy, damp day down on Belfast Dock, the workers were in for one hell of a goddamn shock. For down the cobbles that girl came dressed to kill the lady that's known as Apocalypse Lil. Seventh daughter of a seventh daughter of the Dublin Monto many moons ago. She was born in a lightning storm. Could look in her crystal ball and tell them dock lads just how hazy the forecast bees, how one day there'd be bucky jits on balconies supping cocktails on these harbour streets. Anyway, this particular day down on the dock, with the Belfast confetti bouncing off the rocks, giving the whole scene a carnival sparkle, was when Apocalypse Lil first laid her eyes on that vessel. That's the Titanic, by the way. And by the time the lads wolf whistled that vessel out the dock, Apocalypse Lil was singing New York, New York, from the promenade deck. With only one pack of playing cards to her name and a whole host of rich beggars dying to know their stars. She knew their lingo, see? Yeah, she knew the rich people's bars. She was a child of the Monto. She'd seen them come and go on their tours. Rumour has it, in the meantime, she hooked up with a boiler room hand named Shine, threatened to lay a curse on his head unless he smuggled her inside. Well, I reckon she must have been a wee bit blind with all them dollar signs in her eyes or something, because to this day, there's just no accounting for why she wasn't able to foresee that damn iceberg coming. In fact, on yon fateful midnight, Lil was busy whiting up Shine with powder so the foreman wouldn't realise he was a brother. They felt a sudden shudder through the liner, but were so too used to it to bother. A pile of dimes and pennies from her many forays upstairs went crashing to the ground alongside a cut crystal decanter she'd swiped from the mare. I do declare, said Shine, them rich bitches sure love this freaky shit. And your card tricks and conjuring's been raking it in damn fine. Well, Shiny got drunk. He laughed so hard he thought he'd pissed his pants. Ignored the weird dampness in the air, and he said, girl, shuffle them cards. Tell me my future, Apocalypse Do. Will I ever get my ass out this boiler suit? And will I ever see the promised land? Lil flipped her hand, said, forecast good. But lo, when she moved to reshuffle the pack, well, that common ace of spades, well, it jumped right out of the deck. It laid there on the table, staring Lil right in the eyes, and it made her blood curdle like she'd been encased in ice. My grandmother always warned to heed a jumping card. And look, this ace is on its head, and see here this watermark. And observe that sinking feeling and the chill around your kidneys. And look at this goddamn water shriek chime rising all up over my gaze. Well, Apocalypse Lil, she fled up the stairs to the lock gates. This was round about the time the governor's wife found ice crystals in her swan pate. Arngard, let me see the captain. Have an inkling in me barometer, and I don't think he'll like its forecasting. Get back down in the bowels, Jippo, she said. Take your life and your lice and your vice back to steerage, he said. For there's nobody getting out round here lest they can show me their name in Burke's peerage. Well, the girl tried once. She tried twice. She tried three or four more times, but every time that guard lifted his pistol and he aimed it between her eyes. And she said, one should ye feckin' Egypt, for surely I believe in fate. And I guarantee you'll breathe your last here if you don't open this gate. Well, now it's been an entire century, and those words are proven prophecy. Around these parts, they say, it's a hell of a shame that those rich feckin' Egypts wouldn't open those gates. For apparently, folks, apparently, when that gargantuan block of death tore the arse out of the hull, it left a 300-foot-long emergency exit in the wall. And just the shine and the rest of their kind were about to die through the hollow. Lil swam up behind. I told them time after time that the buckfig in Egypt won't follow. Let's go. And as the final light fizzled out on that fine, fine lady, and as her crates of diamonds dragged her to her watery grave and then hawked her jewellery, Lil and Shine were sipping wine on an ice plate, floating New Orleans way with a crate of Moët champagne that just happened to bob right on by their way, singing, fare thee Titanic, fare thee well. May this be the last will and testament of Apocalypse Lil. Lillian Teresa O'Donnell to her people and her ilk. See, give my love to Belfast. Nah, feck it. Give it to New York too. The ocean, it has no equal. Lest ye ever forget that's true. Thank you very much. I'm not really keeping an eye on the time. Is anybody? Yeah, I'm all right to go on. Now, I don't know if I should actually use the music for this next bit because I can't really hear it. So we'll give it a go, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. So these next two poems are called All the Gorgeous Boys and Girls of War and American Candy. This music is made by a great musician called Arkai. He's from Derry. So, I'll tell you why, right? I have to count myself in 5 seconds from when this tune starts, and if I miss my 5 second mark, the whole thing's fixed. So yeah, this is called American Candy. Oh aye, we know violence. It nurtured us like pups. Insisted our mothers give birth to us prostrate, and in stirrups all, we know violence. It slapped our arses into existence. Gifted our first and last breaths, spoken tongues when it taught us right from wrong, and 1,000 different languages, and all we knew was one, it was violence. Forbade us from pointing our fingers at what we didn't understand, or at the ones who stand accused. It saved the shame of our mothers. Taught some of us that pointing fingers could be guns or magic wands. Violence sometimes sings lullabies instead of rebel songs. Wakes us up to a chorus of bombs in the digital morning and sends us out to war. Hand on hearts to sing a song of subservience with nothing but the exaltation of the city of London in our souls. Or Israel, Vatican, Washington, Zion, the list goes on. It's hand on heart to sing a song of subservience. Oh, we know violence. Every time we try to speak our native languages. Every time we realize entire sections of our blood have been spattered to the four corners of some mythical land called Diaspora. Every time a girl leaves this city because she was raped by great connected men. Every time Jimmy tells the story of being forcibly sedated and waking in another country. Every time I think I might best use my clenched fist to salute rather than break heads, I can feel the violence that I am, and it keeps breathing down my neck. Oh, I know violence. From the threadbare fabric of our fashion households to the sexy shells of Stockholm syndrome. From our hallowed psychopathic representatives to images of pixelated kids without limbs to pick the American candy up off the street with. Oh yeah, we know everything there ever was to know about violence. But when they cast the final die, how many of us are gonna know how to fight? How many of us are gonna know how to fight? Thank you. Woo! This next one's called All the Gorgeous Boys and Girls of War. No matter all the gorgeous boys and girls of war, no matter how many stores dress dead-eyed dolls down in high street military chic, no matter how much tat becomes vintage, or how many shiny magazines suddenly rock derelict in their pictures like Derek Zoolander, minus all irony, no matter how good looking this war is, no matter how good looking this war is, no matter. No matter if they claim that it was all just a game, that the digital villages were uninhabited and all the islands all the same, they were all empty, like America before Columbus came. God forsaken like Africa before the gold trade and the AIDS. The players may change 10 times a day, but the game remains the same. This is lies with no consequences. The battlefields are Las Vegas. Entire continents are craps tables. This prison planet is a gamble by the psychopathic gods who love us just as we love cattle. No matter if I have to play that game to earn a wage. No matter the glycerin tears from Her Majesty's secretary to a family who've been trembling for decades. No matter how shiny its finish, how beautifully tailored its straitjackets, or how many wee blue tablets. No matter how good looking this war is. No matter how good looking this war is. No matter how good looking this war is. I will tell my children different. No matter if the steel from these shackles make work for 1 million citizens, or if all the military men march in perfect unison. No matter how many handcrafted flags flown at half-mast just to be torn to rags by the first storm to pass. No matter how exquisite the stitching, I will tell them war is not a photo album or a news flash. I'll tell them war never sings its own anthems in the bloodbath. War is snowed in secret. It is heart, lungs and stomach seeping through a flak jacket onto the butcher's block. It is human beings processed like livestock. No matter all those gorgeous boys and girls of war, my children will hear how ugly its rancid skin is. When the national anthem is silent, when all the nice girls who loved the sailor caught syphilis. No matter how good looking this war is, no matter how good looking this war is, I will tell my children different. Thank you very much, people. So I'll finish on this one. It's we'll lift the mood a little bit after that. I'm shite at the comedy. I'll finish on this one, and it's a cross between a short story and a poem. And it's about a great friend of mine. I have a friend who's like in his 70s now, and we're great pals, and he's a wild man altogether. And this is about a whole epiphany that he had. He's a materialist and a...
There's something
there. Sorry about that. I thought that was him.
I thought that was just your man saying cheerio. So yeah, I have this friend, and he's in his 70s, and his name is Dermy, and we're great pals. You know, we call for each other the same way I call for my girlfriends, and we play pool together and all this stuff, you know. And he's a wild man altogether for being in his 70s, you know. And he's always, no matter what you ask him, how'd you get on last night, Dermy, it's always, well, I must have had about 17 pints. And then I battered it on, and it was a great night altogether, right? So he's a materialist and a Marxist atheist, but he had this great epiphany in his life a few years back, and this is the story of Dermy's epiphany, and it's called The Fly. Sometimes life has its way of splitting open your mind like a hatchet through the skull to let in a little light. And sometimes that light might manifest itself right before a portal opens for a soul to cash in its tokens and ride out. And for some of us, a few pints of stout and a couple of joints is the closest we've ever been to being at one with the collective consciousness. But then there are others, like my friend Dermy, a Marxist atheist, an all-round general miscreant, mischievous batterer of petrified elderly nuns, who know how the effects of 17 pints can often mimic the symptoms of enlightenment. See, at 17 years of age, Dermy had had an epiphany. It happened like a scene out of Shameless. There were no shiny visions or choirs of angels with voices that made you feel half pissed. No, no, imagine instead one of them gloomy scenes out of The Matrix. Here he was, sitting nursing his pint, miles away from the bar tonight with a gorge on his brow like the Grand Canyon. And when he gets like that, I know I'm about to get some sterling new lines for a poem. Gradually, he occupied his body again, leaned over and confessed the weight off his chest. He checked to see if anyone was listening, and then he said, "There's been a murder, kid." Now, he has such a mode of expression that even the foreboding of callous cold murder has me instantly hanging myself with laughter. "You mad bastard, what are you on about?" I ask him, but he's pouting still. The canyon on his brow's a wee bit deeper, his conscience is bothering him. I say, "Dermy, don't tell me. You've finally done Sister Aloysius in." "Fortunately for us," he said, "Sister Aloysius had already passed peacefully prior to this point, thus Abby and Dermy dodged the devil for another day." By this time, I've sprayed my coffee all over the bar with hilarity, and I'm raking through my bag for a notebook and pen. There's an atmosphere of reverence in the air. I love these chats with him. "I'll tell you what I done, kid," he says. "What, Dermy, for Jesus sake, my nerves are wrecked here. Will you just tell me?" I say. And his nose gets all tinged pink. "Well, I think I must have downed about 17 pints, right?" And that night, I stumbled out the taxi, I crawled up the stairs, and I fell down the spare room for a snooze. Right. By this time, I'm imagining him caving in some intruder's face with a case of wine, one of his many cases of wine, nearly 200 of bottles of wine he had amassed on account of the fact that he felt too bad to tell the wine man that he had enough wine in case the poor man would lose his commission. Anyway, back to me imagining him caving in some intruder's face with a case of wine. The poor swine lying in the spare room, and me and Dermy stood there like Henry Hill and Jimmy Conway discussing the best way to get rid of the body. It's not that my imagination tends to run away with me, it's just that is typical of the nature of our discussions. Random, but never without substance. "So," he says, "I'm lying there in the darkness. Pissed. Blood out. Bananas, Abby. And the next thing, all I hear is this. So, I'm lying there trying to ignore it," he says. "My head's spinning, I'm near ready for the fucking hills, and then I just lost the run of myself with that bastard fly." "Right," says I, "okay, you've murdered a fly." "Aye," he says, broken bits for himself. "Because it wasn't just murder, oh no. It turns out that murder was premeditated and cold and involved 20 minutes careful planning, including Dermy sliding out of the bed as silent as a commando, crawling low across the floor armed only with a rolled up copy of the Derry Journal, remembers his own psychotic fingers reaching for that switch, knew that the poor bloody fly would see the light from the telly screen and didn't have it in its nature to resist. Bzz, bzz, bzz. With the murderous drilling through the annals of his mind. Having in that moment forgotten to respect all life, he sweeps one swift swipe and goes at the fly, happily eating its own shite off the screen, and in the next millisecond, he had knocked the bastard dead. Now, it might have been the 17 pints, right? But neither you nor I believe that, Jeremy. In fact, Pamela tells me a similar thing happened to Jack Kerouac and Rabbi Burns. There were just nemooses in your house that night. Only a fly. And as he sat there on the end of his bed, meditating on the wee corpse, well, he had that epiphany. "You know what I realised, kid?" he says. "I realised that all the big shot scientists, all our biologists and archaeologists and nurses and surgeons and geneticists and cosmeticists in the world, in the entire world, when brought together in an almighty combined effort, wouldn't stand a snowball's chance in holy sweet living mother of hell of recreating that fly. Ah, says I understand. I put my notebook and pen back in my bag. Some things are just beyond words, Derms. Thanks very much for...